Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Dedicated to Henry Farman. In the year of the primal thought, from the dawn of terrestrial birth, man mastered the mammoth and fort, and man was the lord of the earth. He made him an olive skin from the heart of an olive tree. He compassed the earth therein, and man was the lord of the sea. He controlled the vigor of steam, he harnessed the lightning for hire, he drove the celestial team, and man was the lord of the fire.
Greetings and felicitations, children of technology. Welcome to episode 42 of Agitators Anonymous. And this one is a special guest episode. This is my good mate, JB from Grand Magus. Easily one of my very favorite straight down the line heavy metal bands of the last decade or two. And easily one of my favorite singers out there. JB has a very calm, laconic, measured interview style that goes along with his singing style, his playing style, all of these things. And we get into all of that. In fact, most of the interview is not about the normal things you usually hear me giving out about every week. In fact, it's about songwriting, singing, vocal techniques, all of these kind of things, about music, about heavy metal, all of those kind of stuff. So hang in there while I do the three ad reads and let's get down to some JB from Grand Magus. So, www.metalblade.com. If you're in North America, use the promo code AA Podcast and you will get 10% off your order. www.hatecouture616.com. HateCouture. Use the promo code Alan and you will get free shipping. Hateful yet tasteful apparel. Lots of nasty merchandise. Go and check it out. And www.lotfp.com. Lamentations of the Flame Princess. If you're into RPGs, role-playing games, all that kind of stuff, go and check them out. And if you order 3 books, you will get 2 of the author's choice sent to you. You just need to use the promo code AAAA, 4 A's, and that'll do it. If you wish to support the show, it's patreon.com, Alan Avril with 2 capital A's, where I post other podcasts, bonus songs, unreleased, this, that, and the other. Go and check that out as well. All right, let's get into it. Right, let's do it. Some heavy metal chat with another heavy metal singer in another heavy metal band. Is that enough heavy metal for you? Right. JB from Grand Magus.
And so how have you been coping? Have you been trying to write songs or what have you, like, personally, I found it, I don't know, a bit unsort of, when people said to me, oh, look, it'll inspire you to write more music. And it hasn't, because I sort of resent it because I'm not allowed to do anything. And I don't want to be just end up playing here and, you know, writing songs online. That's not why I started a band. So I sort of resent doing it. I won't take part in an online show. I'm just not doing it. But the podcast is what I sort of put my energy into. But, you know, people are coping in different ways. Have you been writing? So have you been writing songs or what?
No, I'm exactly like you in that sense. I don't feel any inspiration to write music. band Grand Magus, we will never do any kind of live streaming shows and stuff like that. Because like you said, that was not the reason you started to play heavy metal in the first place. For me, the whole thing is about the interaction between the audience and the band. You know, I can really enjoy watching a DVD from a concert, you know.
Yeah.
That's one thing. But watching people standing in their rehearsal room playing a show online, it's like, and, you know, I don't criticize those who do it, but it's not for me. Then I'd rather just leave it alone until things, I feel like before, I'm sure you feel the same way, that there was this whole machine going on with music, and you were in that machine, and that machine just kept on rolling, and you were in it somehow, and now the machine just stopped.
Yeah.
And that gives you time. Number one, you get kind of thrown out from it because it doesn't exist anymore, and that affects your frame of mind as well.
Yeah.
And it gives you time to kind of reflect on other stuff, you know, in life. So,
Yeah, it's very complicated. I mean, I've sort of gone through, some of my friends think I'm in some sort of state of mourning for this previous life that you had, because you were so involved in it, and you realize that your life was kind of extraordinary in a sense, you know, traveling and playing, and now it's very, very ordinary. And if you've been used to that, the sort of, you know, what the rush of stepping onto a stage and that kind of thing, and the traveling and the adventure, to have all of it removed. And it's not just the economic circumstance. People say to me, oh, you can make money online. And you're sort of saying, you know, that's besides the point. I'd tour for nothing, to be honest, you know. And it is hard if you've put in all of the years, and this is the kind of thing you've put all of your, I suppose, your self into, to have it just removed to nothing. It's very, I found it very difficult to cope with, just because I'm just not used to just being in Dublin for a year. Yeah. And of course, then all the coping mechanisms aren't there, and that you can't go out to the pub. There's no, or anything. Like, there's just nothing to do. I'm just like running up and down the canal every day, trying not to go mad. But it is, it's a very difficult situation to cope with. And especially the fact that you're not given any line on the horizon in the future to work towards, where that's, you're being told, okay, this is when, you know, because we, let's be honest, we're going to be the last people out of the pen we are, you know.
No, I totally agree. But also, you've been doing this for longer than I have, but it's been 20 years of touring, recording, touring, recording. And for me, it's also been on my mind that it would be nice to just have a break, just take a break, because we do it like you guys do it out of passion. And it's, I think that's something that you need to be a bit careful with, so you don't end up just doing it without feeling it 100%, you know. And so for me, this break was kind of not that bad. Because it allowed me to get a break without it being my decision, if you know what I mean, to step away from something. So I'm personally, and luckily, I'm not like chomping at the bit for this to end. I just feel that I'm not gonna do it until it's something comparable to what it was before.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Kieran from Primordial, he has a similar attitude to you, in that over the last few years he talked about, I want a summer off. Of course, but of course there's, you know, the income that everybody gets from the band subsidizes their normal jobs, which is the sort of like the living on top of the surviving percentage, you know. For me, if we'd said, okay, we're all taking a year off, I would have packed my bag and fucked off to South America or something. Like, I can't just be stationary. And that's what kills me, is that I not only do I feel the rules of, for example, lockdown are, I view them as an affront to civil liberty on some level. Of course, there's a health crisis as well, but most people are not observing, I think, the, you know, the complications this is going to have for our surveillance society, civil liberty. So I worry about all of those other things because I guess I have the time to be driven insane by it. So I feel kind of like a yoke has been placed, a structure upon you that you can't really escape. And so I wouldn't have minded a break if it was on my own terms and I could go, okay, I'm unplugged, out from social media, gone. But now I'm just more in front of a screen than ever. And, you know, it's we're all starting to look old and insane. And, you know, it's driving me like sort of, because I have no, I've been trying to explain this to people as well. I have no, you've no outlet for your power, your energy, your, that sort of emotional transaction, but also that's a sort of elements of maleness and stuff that nobody really wants to talk about anymore. Yeah, because we don't have sport, but the gyms aren't open. There's nothing, there's no outlet for your energy at all. So yeah, I understand kind of what you mean. I guess I've always been a bit more relentless or reckless or sort of always put all of my energy into this thing. So to just be like, okay, now you're just going to sit around and read books for a year. Maybe, but I would have wanted to fuck off somewhere. You've been sort of coping reasonably well with it then.
Yeah, I think so. I have a job, so yeah. And that's been good, you know. If I'd just been sitting around at home, I'd probably go mad, like me. You're kind of implying that you're doing.
Yeah.
But so and I guess I've been focusing more on that than I normally would. On the other hand, knowing that the band is there has been kind of like a, like an emergency vent or a, something very nice to know that, yeah, well, it's just a job, you know. In a couple of months, we'll be on tour and with all the kind of what's it called, the gratification and the you know, getting all that from the people who watch you, and that's something absolutely that I miss, you know. But that's also kind of a tall order, considering how things are now.
That's true.
And what I kind of think about sometimes is that how lucky we were to have experienced, you know, decades of this metal madness that we had.
Yeah.
And you know, having 400 people in a venue that takes 200, and the sweat and the drink and the madness and all the, you know, love, really, which to me now seems like, did that really happen, you know?
Yeah.
If you look at the world as it is today, and I just feel that, wow, maybe that was it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I have the conversations like this with, you know, Keith from Destroyer, and he just said to me, he goes, mate, I think the party's over. And it's like, you know, I kind of, part of me is unwilling to quite just give up on, of course, everything that we've created over all the years. But at the same time, a part of me does wonder, like, yeah, maybe, because, you know, once you really, there are people who have still have, you know, the hope that everything is going to go back to normal. When, you know, like when you're inside the industry, but you realize not only just really banal and boring things like, insurance companies aren't going to insure a venue that doesn't have all of the, you know, that everybody in there isn't vaccinated in the net. How long is that percentage going to take? Flying, you know, baggage for flying. If you need to get vaccinated in and out, then there's no fee for bands, blah, blah, blah. If there's a cap on the room that's 20%, 30%, that means we would have to pay in a 2,500 capacity room. And all of a sudden, once you unravel the, let's say, the positivity of belief that it's going to come back, that's when I start to kind of go, okay, this might not come back as we imagined, you know, unless the world decides that health and safety isn't the overriding concern for life, for the, you know, or it's health and safety with all these other things. But yeah, part of me, we were talking about it and he was just like, can you see really 300 people being allowed into a 300 capacity venue to rage to a band like they used to? And unfortunately, the kind of music that we're involved in, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
So, there's a part of me that just like you wonders like, okay. But I feel kind of very much cut adrift then from all of the things that you were. So how do you redefine yourself in middle age once you've lived a sort of analog life? Because if the life is just being on a screen, I can't see any reason for making any more heavy metal.
No, I kind of agree with you. This is a big topic, and obviously something that you've been thinking a lot about, and so have I.
Yeah.
But I definitely think that if the itch comes back to write music, I wouldn't have any problem, you know, doing albums.
Yeah, I think we'll make one more primordial for sure, because we started rehearsing it before we got locked down.
Yeah, okay.
But...
But the other thing is that, like you kind of hinted at, that I'm not interested in doing, you know, social distancing gigs. And now I'm not talking about the streaming stuff, but I'm talking about, like you said, that we can only have this venue half filled and people have to stand 3 meters apart from each other. You know, that's then... it's not heavy metal anymore. And if you do music where people can sit down and enjoy it, you know, that's fine. But that's like 90% gone from a heavy metal show.
Yeah.
And those 90% that they were the reason that I wanted to play heavy metal, you know?
Yeah.
So, I'm not trying to be pessimistic about it. I feel more like is it a word in English? Laconic.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, laconic.
Yeah, so I'm kind of like the chips will fall some way or another, and I'm just waiting for it, but I'm not holding my breath.
but my observation, you're generally a pretty sort of calm, laconic is a good word actually, you're sort of like a calm person anyway, who could probably deal with this much better than me, because I'm a bit more sort of well, sometimes, but it's not always my go-to mode of engaging with these things. But yeah, I do worry that, like, as we said, like, yeah, that's the things, whether it's well, if anything with moving parts, any music, whether it's indie, goth, rock, all of these things that we consider legacy systems or old analog living ways of life, all of those things. Most people will say to me, oh, look, human nature will dictate that people will want to come back and see live music. But you see, and people keep sending me screenshots of, look what's happening in New Zealand or in Australia. But then when you actually examine it, what you find is a state-sponsored festival where people buy tickets and are allowed into their little pen with the people you've bought the tickets for. And there's a little sort of system where people bring beer. So in a way, is it any different than being in North Korea and, you know, being having the state sponsored opera is the only thing you can see? That's my rather cynical view of these things. But if everything is going to have this, you know, the process and system around it of corporatism, the sort of, I guess, the pandemic corporatism around it, then we're going to end up with just like state validated shows or no sense of expression that isn't just part of the state apparatus. And that really worries me, because that for art, for dissent, for, well, I suppose the rebellious nature of what heavy metal was, if we bring it right down to some sort of base level, that's really worrying, because then that means there's no gig around the corner for 100 kids, you know, with their thrash band, and, you know, there's no small venues because they need to reinstall ventilation this and scanning machines, and no insurance company will insure them in case any. So again, that's what I kind of worry about, like, all right, we're moving into state-sponsored freedom of expression, which, you know.
Well, yeah,
you can see where my mind is.
Yeah, but Alan, you can't worry about things like that.
Welcome to my life.
Yeah, but you know, it's like there's nothing you can do about it, and also it's not your problem. You're too old to care about that.
Well, I don't know. I kind of disagree. It sort of is our problem because it affects who we are, our sense of ourselves, our creativity, and all this kind of thing. Like, you know, if they say, okay, you know, literally, you have your 5 kilometer radius, you can't go outside. Well, then it really does. I think it does kind of affect, because I understand what you mean in the grand scheme. Who are we? But if it affects, you know, your ability to be, you know, an artist or creative or make music, then I suppose I kind of feel like it is my business, but I'm not able to switch off from it and not think about it, you know?
Yeah, I understand. But do you mean, I mean, obviously you care about what happens to Primordial, and obviously I care about what happens to Grand Magus, but I can't say that I worry that much about the future generations of heavy metal, you know. Because why should I? I mean, I'm not president of the Union of the Heavy Metal.
No,
I'm in a band, and that band is the only thing I care about, you know. And obviously, my friends in other bands, but you know. And I'm just gonna say that if we find this difficult, imagine being a new band.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've just recorded our new album, our first album, and now we were going on tour, and we've been a band for 2 years, you know.
Yeah.
Forget about that.
Well, they don't, in a sense, they don't know what they're missing to miss it.
No.
But I totally understand you. Well, I'll put it to you this way. A friend of mine said to me, we were discussing this, and she said, why do you give a fuck about the theatre? You never went to the theatre. And I went, and I said to her, well, I give a fuck about artistic expression, its place in culture and society, and the fact that, you know, standing in the square telling a story is one of the oldest forms of interaction known to man. And if those are removed, I guess what it is that I'm railing against the anti-humanism of this whole process. And wherever I see it, I'm sort of again instinctively against it. So I'm supporting every, I suppose, expression that is opposed to that, even if it's something that seems like, say, the theatre. I never went to the theatre, but I feel sad for my friends who take part in that, who aren't able to do that anymore. And the idea that we won't have the theatre anymore somehow seems terribly depressing or culturally reductive to me. Yeah. You know?
Now, in that sense, I totally agree with you, obviously. And like I mentioned, I worry about restaurants and stuff. Because for me, I mean, restaurants are also a part of culture in a very big way, you know, and the places that you really love, and, you know, you love the food and you love the people and you love the surroundings and everything. And you just think that, wow, they're going to be gone, you know, in 6 months or something. Mm-hmm. And that really gets to me, and absolutely about the culture in a larger sense. But I think that theater, opera, classical music, it's absolutely going to survive this. Mm-hmm. But like you mentioned, the small dingy clubs that we started playing in with maybe half a toilet for, you know, 300 people, and you know, the roof is nearly caving in, and, you know, all that we've experienced, that's going to be a problem, obviously.
Yeah.
But that's more like a heavy metal problem, maybe, or punk and thrash and, you know, stuff like that.
Rock and roll, eh? Yeah,
rock and roll, yeah. But I don't see that theater in particular is part of that problem, or they're not going to be as damaged, I think.
Maybe not, maybe not. I suppose it's sitting and seated and distanced, and comedy theoretically could come back and stuff, you know?
Yeah. But I have a very positive speculation about this, like an effect of this, and that would be that you know, the creator's fee when it comes to writing music and getting something for people listening to it. I'm not talking about gigs now, I'm talking about there will be huge steps towards some kind of reasonable situation with that, which means that you could again have people surviving on just writing music, you know, like Dark Throne and Bathory did.
Why do you think that?
Because it, otherwise, the only thing that's going to exist is, you know, amateur music.
Yeah.
And that's not enough, I think, for people.
No, I mean, anecdotally, everyone I speak to who's working at the big labels and metal labels, they have often told me this has been their best year. The first month or two were difficult. And then when people recalibrated and went, oh, we're not going anywhere, orders online started going up. So paradoxically, as awful as musicians are doing, the labels are doing really, really well. Okay. That's a really strange situation, you know?
Okay. Well, what I meant is that what happened during our heyday, which might not be over yet, what happened was that, you know, record sales dropped and the live thing became what you did.
Yeah.
And so all the circumstances around touring became so much better than when we started. You know, there was so many more venues, everything was, you know, you got paid better, everything was organized much better, and there were, you know, 500 bands on tour in every European country at any point in time. And obviously that's not happening now. And so something has got to change or revert, maybe a bit at least, back to the way it was before.
And you think that the streaming platforms are going to be sort of allow that to happen? Or you think that you mean just people ordering stuff directly, or?
I don't know. I don't know. But I think that the thirst and the desire for music is never going to disappear, you know. And if you can't see bands live, you're going to want to, you know, have a part of it somehow.
Hopefully, I just wonder. Yeah.
Sorry.
No. I'm not sure. It's not something I've really thought about, to be honest. The labels are doing really, really well. I'm just not sure the streaming services are going to, you know, revise their rates. But I wanted to pivot a bit and ask you about something, because I'm sure people in the opening, say, bit of this will be like, oh, they're talking about the pandemic and all this kind of stuff. Ask them about singing, you know, might just be a bit more a bit more interesting for some people. But one thing I'm really curious about is like the Stockholm scene of the 80s, like just a completely changed direction and stuff, because I was watching these for some reason I was watching this sort of badly put together footage of Quorthon signing in a record store in 86 in Stockholm, and everybody I speak to from that era in the Swedish scene kind of says there were no gigs and no venues, but still loads of bands, but not really any metal pub where people met and that kind of stuff. So I just wanted to sort of pivot a bit to like Stockholm and say 88 or 87, 89, and what sort of scene you were, if you were, and, you know, sort of your recollections of that time, because that's when all the death metal was about to explode. And what were you doing then?
Well, I was in Falun, where I grew up. So I was quite away from Stockholm. So I don't have any kind of first-hand experience of what was going on at that time. But on the other hand, when I moved to Stockholm, this was mid-90s, I became, you know, friends with all the death metal guys and the black metal guys in Stockholm. So they've told me all about this time, you know, and what happened. And I think what you said is basically true. What happened was that they played at, you know, youth halls and stuff, and hall sounds like it's something big, but, you know, youth cafes and
Folka Parkett or whatever it's called.
No. This is even smaller. It's like, you know, this little, like a small thing that people went to after school, or had, you know, small gatherings. So, because, like you said, I don't think there were like maybe two or three mid-size venues in Stockholm. And these bands, I mean, these guys, they were 16, 17 when they started.
Yeah.
So they weren't even allowed to, you know, to organize gigs at those places. So they just put together stuff themselves, totally amateur night, you know.
So what was your first, you just sort of like literally packed up the guitar and moved to Stockholm in 95, 96, or how did it go? Like, what was your first band then? Before that, you must have been playing with something.
Yeah, well, I was, I moved from where I grew up to a town called Uppsala, where I went to university. Yeah, so I started a few bands there. And one of those bands I kind of carried with me to Stockholm. And then I got together with some new people, and we even put an ad out where, you know, to get a drummer and stuff like that. So, and in that kind of very primordial state of Grand Magus, we played a gig, and Fred Espy from Dismember was doing the in-house front of house sound, and he thought we were really good and said that, hey, if you ever get a record contract and record an album, I'd be happy to record it for you, you know. So that was kind of like the first boot into this pretty close-knit fraternity and circle of people in Stockholm, people who've been raising hell in Stockholm for 10 years or something. And then, you know, I got to know more people, and I my girlfriend, who's still my girlfriend, she knew all these people. So when we became an item, I was kind of introduced to everyone. And from there on, things became a lot more easy, you know, when it comes to rehearsal spaces and stuff like that. So at one point we shared rehearsal room with Dismember and Dark Funeral.
Okay.
You know, so it's a very small world in Stockholm anyway, you know. Or at least it was.
Yeah, and people will want me to ask you, but when did you know that moment where you knew you could sing? Like, because I started off and we had rehearsals in end of 91, 92, and I wanted to do this kind of mesmerized, you know, kind of into the pandemonium Christian death kind of goth voice I didn't know what I was doing. And then gradually on the first album, there's a few songs that have clean singing, and I'd never heard myself sing properly. And then where the guy recorded it, I was like, oh, it's not too bad. But that moment where you went, oh, okay, I think I can do this a bit, but you must have been a bit more, I imagine it must have been a bit more instant for you, no?
Well, actually, it was kind of a fluke, because our singer, he left the band, and so we were a four piece. I just thought that maybe I should just try. And so I did. And it felt very, it felt very natural somehow. That's all I can say. I mean, it's
yeah. But it always seems to me like you have a really naturally effortless style at being able to be sort of calm and play the guitar and sing. And it always struck me because I'd watch and I go, like, it just seems so effortless. Where very often I'm like fucking pushing stuff and jumping around and all sorts of stuff. And it just is the kind of calm way you did it struck me like, oh, this must have always been effortless or a very easy thing for you to fall into and do, you know. That's my observation on the outside.
Well, thank you. No, I mean, I think that it felt very natural. On the other hand, like the first gigs and stuff, I was very, like this. And then I felt that, hey, this doesn't work. You know, you just completely sever your vocal cords if you push too hard, you know.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you have like two different types of vocal approaches as well. I mean, you have the more screamy style, but you also have a more like singing type voice as well. And when you do that, do you push?
I kind of find like I don't like say when I would watch and you sing, you have a sort of natural sort of bottom end to your voice that I don't really have. Mine is a bit sort of middling, but that it's that, you know, like getting the grit into the singing voice.
Yeah.
Is that like getting over the hump of doing that, which would destroy my voice when I started doing it like 2002, 2003, then you kind of become used to it and you learn to, you just kind of project it from here and make it be less of a head voice and more of a chest voice. And sort of you learn to just project it a lot better. And now that sort of, let's say the Blackie Lawless grit that you add into the singing initially was the hardest thing to do and to keep and maintain. And now I find it easier, you know, but that's not really something you don't really put as much into the voice. You know, I find it's harder, but it's, you're able to hold and go through notes once you figure out how to do it. Easier, like the first thing that disappears with my voice on tour is that voice, that clean voice. I can still do and do it in notes, but or I have to go down an octave and then go through it. But I tend to kind of sing quite loud and sort of force it from here, but it's gone from being here to here, which I think is maybe technically a better thing to do. I don't know, where does yours come from?
I'm also quite loud, so I guess there's a lot of air being pushed around, which is not necessarily a good thing. I think that the real key to any kind of longevity singing wise is to be relaxed, even though it doesn't sound like you are. You mentioned Blackie Lawless. He's got this amazing, you know, it's like a gravelly distortion without being, it's totally unique voice, really. Yeah. But he's also got incredible stamina. He sounds like that today, and the guy is fucking old, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry, Blackie. and I think he's just perfected. And he just had a natural technique to begin with that was very relaxed. And all the, you know, like LG, for instance, in Entombed. Mm. Also, I mean, the guy sounds like he's trying to fucking kill someone, but he's completely relaxed, you know. He's just, Jörgen Sandström, you know, from Graven.
Sure. I played football with him.
Yeah, he's also got this fucking amazing, brutal voice that's just at the same time really relaxed. Yoni in Unleashed, same thing.
Yeah.
But those are death metal voices.
Yeah.
You have much more of a, like a, I wouldn't say like a black metal voice, but it's
sometimes
a lot more kind of aggressive. I would say aggressive in a different way, more like
That was my intention, was to mix, but I always liked the style of, like, you know, the kind of Slades and you know, Phil Mogg and UFO, the phrasing, always to have the diction really good, and the hard and soft consonants, which I know, like, it's one of the things I love about Grand Magus is the delivery and diction within the clear vocal is so, like, you don't need the lyric sheet, which I always tried to make very clear with Primordial as well, the pronunciation and the enunciation, you know, because I still remember the sort of techniques, the vowel techniques before playing live that you were telling me about. But I kind of took a bit from 70s singers. I like the, you know, the kind of getting the, you know, when you're sort of recording and you're editing the words to fit the syncopation sometimes, and you're moving in vowels. And I'm, in my head, I'm like, fill in it, Phil Mogg, especially UFO, you know, Bad Company. That's kind of that voice, that, you know, that natural 70s grit in the voice was something I wanted to put with my black metal kind of voice. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. And one big thing that you touched upon there is how you write your lyrics. Because people who don't sing and write lyrics, they tend to have a lot of words. And words that don't really work. And for me, I'm really, really, I'm really, really paying attention to the words with the music. Usually that's something that, let's say you're recording a song and you do your first vocal takes, and you realize that, you know, get rid of the here.
Totally.
Get rid of the of here. You can't have a word like, liability. Maybe that's a perfect word. But, you know, we have to, rewrite the lyrics to be able to sing with power and projection, you know.
I totally agree. I sometimes I'm editing them like take to take, going, oh, you'd cut that, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
Because you don't want the wrong consonants or the wrong emphasis on the wrong bit, you know.
Exactly. And that's very hard to know when you're sitting down at home writing lyrics. It's not until you kind of put them to the test that you realize that, you know, there's five prepositions in here that just fuck this line up completely, you know.
Yeah.
So get rid of it. You know?
And that's always the mastery behind, like, Dio or something, or Priest.
Yeah.
But especially Dio, to make it sound so simple.
Yeah.
I remember going to Hole in the Sky and to sing a few songs. In the end, we did Pentagram and Iron Maiden with these bunch of teenagers, very talented dudes. I just got up and sang with them, and they wanted to do Kill the King. And I was like, this, forget it. And it's only when you really analyze Kill the King, you hear the hard, soft consonant rolling with the bass drum. And the bass, you know, and you're like, Jesus Christ, it's so locked into the rhythm, regardless of the guitar. It's just mastery of, and also the lyrics themselves, you know. I always thought there was a touch of the Dio about what you were doing, though, you know.
Well, it's interesting that you brought that up, because I totally agree with you. And he was really a master of that, and I think the reason that he was a master of that was that he was such a great singer, you know, so that he knew that in order for my vocals to really come through, they have to really, really fit with the music, go with the music. Because if you just sing a bunch of words, that, you know, then you're going to sound weak and no one's going to understand what you're singing. And the music is going in that direction and your vocals are going in that direction. So, and also he used a lot of pretty long notes, you know. He wasn't like this. He was more like, wah, you know. And that was a huge inspiration for me. And also, you know, if you read my lyrics, they're not very long, you know.
Yeah, I have the same thing.
Yeah, and I feel that if you play this type of, well, you're even, you know, Primordial is even more epic than what we do. We're more, you know, towards the Manowar thing, but you have really long epic stuff. And if you just go on blabbering lyrics through that, it's going to sound silly.
Yeah, well, I think it's part of the sort of the drama or the dynamics of the song to know which bit to sing over, which bit to let it go. Especially if you've got an 8 or 9 minute long song, which is slowly unfolding. You don't want to go everything. Personally, I like sometimes being leaning into my own state of not wanting to always go with the natural rhythm, or to, you know, to sing across the lines, like like landing on the note through the processes underneath, which I think maybe other singers would follow the duk-duk-duk-duk-duk. I like straining across and landing on the other side, almost like jumping over a river that you don't know you're going to land on the other bank kind of thing, which you know, I was talking to Addy from Salsifer about this, and he was like, what the fuck? That's totally the opposite thing of what I would put there. And I was there like, okay, that's good. Because gives you the character of, you know, but I'm totally aware, as exactly what you're saying, of editing out the unnecessary words, which is very often when you look at the lyric sheet, people go, why is that word on the lyric sheet, but you're not singing? I go, oh, well.
yeah, that happens as well sometimes. But there's also a difference. I mean, your music is much less traditional than our, I mean, most of our songs are, you know, they have a chorus, you know, like a big chorus and verse, chorus, blah, blah, blah. And it's much more, much more traditional, I would say. I mean, your stuff is more, I wouldn't say experimental, but it's less governed by form.
I think you're right, yeah. But when you're writing, like, are you sitting with the guitar and then you put the melody, vocal melody afterwards, or are you thinking, going around thinking about, like, I often write lyrics on my phone randomly these days, and then I go back, or if I'm writing for Dread Sovereign, sometimes I put the riff around the lyric, but which is not very musical, but are you just messing around on the guitar at home, or how does it come out? Like,
yeah, pretty much usually starts with that I'm out walking or doing whatever, and I think of a melody line.
Really? Singing?
Yeah. Yeah.
But do you sing it in your phone then, or what do you do?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. You wouldn't imagine how much rubbish I have my phone. You know. And I usually, for the longest period, I usually just have nonsense words.
Really?
Yeah.
That's very Metallica thing to do. If you listen to the demos of And Justice for really? All, James is just going, like Harvest of Sorrow, before he puts the words in. I never did that. I never made the kind of, but my mate Rob from Vomitor, he goes, he records the riffs with his into his phone, which is like, he playing the back to me going, listen to that, which is like, you know, broke my brain. I mean, it was amazing to hear, but like,
do you use the guitar when you write songs?
I mean, for Dread Sovereign, yeah. I mean, for Primordial, it's more Kieran comes in with an idea usually, and we don't trade files. We won't do anything like that. So we have to meet in the room, and everybody sits, and he goes, here's an idea. And everybody kind of will put their bits together, or somebody might go, I might go, hey, remember that song we did 6 months ago? What would that bit fit here? Or Kieran, either sometimes he'd have the whole song mapped out, written out. Mick is very methodical. He has all his parts worked out. And we all sort of structure it together, you know. So you're kind of all involved in the process.
That's cool.
Do you bring in entire songs to rehearsal room then? Or is everybody allowed to fiddle about with what you've done or what?
It's been a bit different over the years. But since I'm the guitar player in the band and the singer, I have the luxury of being able to, you know, do complete songs if I want to, you know, and that's been done in the past. That doesn't mean that I've decided what what you know, Fox or Ludwig are going to be playing. But on the other hand, like for the last album, what I just mentioned, that type of process is not nearly as fun, as much fun as start from scratch in the rehearsal room,
yeah,
and just do it together. And then from that, I can take it back on my own and kind of fiddle around with it a bit and yeah, see what kind of music or melody ideas I have. And then, you know, we just, you know, process it together the day after and et cetera. And for me, that's the way we did it on the last album. That's the way we did it on Hammer of the North and pretty much all the albums preceding that one. But there was like three albums where I wrote most of the stuff on my own with, you know, in garage band.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it turned out cool. I'm not displeased with those albums at all, but it was so much more fun to do it this way.
Yeah, it has
also, yeah, and that's the way it should be. I mean, if you're a band,
yeah,
I'm not saying for other bands necessarily. I mean, every band's different, but for us, that's really the, and that's one of the most fun parts of being in a band as well, writing yeah, stuff together in the rehearsal room.
Yeah,
I think
it's the human process of it as well, you know.
Yeah,
it's also the just the interaction, I suppose, the camaraderie, the idea that you're, it's one of the words that I've been using a lot to describe this last year is agency. And people sometimes are confused what I mean, but you know, okay, so you take the thing that you create in the rehearsal room, right, which eventually will make, you know, be on a record that a record label presses, that people work there, that's distributed, people bring it to maybe to shops, the merch table, people come to a show. So that one, I often think about this, the one riff that you write is the stone dropping in the pool that spreads the ripples out, which yeah, which is agency, which eventually ends up with you standing on the stage singing,
yeah, yeah,
400 people in the room, and that transfer of humanity, energy, joy, whatever, you know, makes sound yeah, strange for me to say that being the cynical old goat that I am, but that's the lack of agency, because all of a sudden there's no stone to drop in the water that doesn't ripple out. Whether it's, you know, like sometimes I really enjoy, you arrive at a fest in the morning at the airport, and it's the same driver from the previous year, and I talk about football for the 2-hour journey to the festival because he's the same guy from last year, and we argue about yeah, all those little small bits of the puzzle. That may sound really banal, but I think are really sort of important to the stone dropping in the water. And but it all comes from that first impulse, that first riff, you know, that you that yeah, you make in the rehearsal room. I think about that a lot, you know.
Yeah, I think that's very astute and very much to the point. Two things, I mean, number one, like you were hinting at, is that human life is about the details.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a cliche, but it's really the small things that matter the most in the long run, you know. And that little detail that you mentioned, you know, that riff, that instead of doing this, doing that, and yeah, that makes the whole difference, you know. And playing heavy metal music, it's the small nuances that is the key to a new song, because you're basically reinventing the wheel every time, you know.
Yeah, but there's only X amount of notes or whatever, yeah.
Exactly. And the other thing is that if you do everything yourself, you can never have that almost ecstatic feel when you're in the rehearsal room and you have a riff and you fiddle around with it and then the drummer just does something,
yeah, yeah,
that, you know, blows your mind, and everyone is in it together, and you, it's almost like an out of body experience, I think.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that doesn't happen when you sit on your own. I mean, you can be very pleased with a song that you've written,
yeah,
but when you do that quantum leap together at the same time in the same room, That's almost unbeatable. Only a really, really perfect gig can come close to that.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like I like the kind of, if you want a heavy metal phrase for it, the alchemy of the situation, you know?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But so how come you always resisted getting another guitar player then? I like the idea of a power trio, but do you ever feel a bit lost on a really big stage?
No.
Not lost is not the right word, but, you know, like sometimes a huge expanse of the stage, like with Primordial, I get to, you know, I can, you know, do black metal Bruce Dickinson and run around and stuff. But how come you always, you never wanted another guitar? Or maybe you did, I don't know.
Well, that's the age-old question. I think for me, some of the biggest influences that I've had are Motorhead. You know, Venom. And I just thought it was really cool that three people could make so much noise, you know.
Yeah. Like I don't think it's lacking. I like it. I like those influences as well. But I was just wondered, what was your impetus for that, or did you get sick of people asking you about it? As I'm sure.
I think that when you've done something for such a long time, you're kind of unwilling to change it because that's become the identity of the band. And also on a big stage, I think it's really cool to be that band. Fuck me, they're only three people. What are they doing on that whacking stage? You know, it looks crazy, but the sound is, you know, we always had pretty good sound engineers. And,
For sure, yeah.
And that gives it, I think, you know, music is all about different flavors, really.
Yeah.
If all heavy metal bands had two guitars and you know, a separate lead singer, like Judas Priest, then okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's awesome, but it's also pretty fun to be only three people and playing these big stages, you know, and usually it's like, okay, how could they possibly pull this off without backing tracks and stuff like that? And you know, we do. We don't sound like Rammstein, you know, but we make some noise, and all the noise, even if it's bad, is it real? At least totally real, you know. If I break a string, that's it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like that.
And so, of the records, though, I mean, objectively, people ask me this, and I don't really have it. They say, "Oh, what's your favorite?" or "What's your favorite album?" They said, I don't really think of it like that. There's songs I prefer to play live and not play live, but I sort of love all the albums for different reasons. I think they're just kind of like they mark you in your position in your life, and I'm not. Yeah, exactly. I like the fact that some of them are flawed in their sound or character. But do you have favorites or what? Or is there any missteps that you regret?
The last album is my favorite. No. there are things that I would have done differently. But like you said, they're a testament to where you were at that point in time. And I think that's the most important thing for a band, that's about honesty.
Yeah.
I know that you are, and Graham Magus is definitely that, which is why our albums don't sound the same. Because you change over time, and you can change, you can also change back to the way you were, and you can go in a different direction. And every album we've done has been like a very honest representation of where we were at that time.
Yeah.
But then you have circumstances when it comes to who mixed it and how they were feeling at that time and stuff like that. And sometimes it doesn't work out the way you want it. But hey, you can't be like that guy. I don't know if it's true, but there's a story about this famous artist, painter, who was caught by the guards in the Louvre because he was sitting and trying to alter his painting that All was right. on display. And they were like, hey, man, I know this, you did this, but it's over. It's ours now. You know, you can't change this now.
Yeah, I like the idea. I think heavy metal needs to be. I think that you shouldn't second guess yourself, is how I feel. So with Dread Sovereign, it's very instinctual. It's like, okay, this is the good vibe. Let's go for it. I often feel like that with vocal takes. If I feel it's right, I could do a whole song in one go. And if it goes, and you fall on a word, I go, oh, well, that's how I sound. Fucking leave it. I'm not a perfectionist. I rather it sort of frames you at that moment. Where your instinct was on top. And I find that if you trust in your instinct, very often it works better than going returning to try and fix a little thing. I'm not like that at all. Like, do you find yourself going back fiddling with things with the vocals and tinkering? I tend to just fucking like leave it. I'll do 2 hours of really intense work with singing and I'll like rip through whole songs and then go back and fiddle with the odd thing. But generally, I'll do the singing of a whole album in a day if I could, or 2 days, 2 days mostly. And then a few layers and a few theater, but I want to belt through it. There's nothing more interminable than sitting there going, and trying to fix the harmony perfectly. It's like, that's not me, you know, or maybe it's laziness. I don't know.
you've had producers who are too nice. No, too lenient.
Yeah, maybe so.
No, that's cool. I mean, that's really impressive. I don't think I could do, I mean, I could do vocals in 2 days, but I don't think I would be pleased with it, you know. For me, it's, I really want to know that it's the best that I can do. And depending on who we're recording with as well. I mean, when we did quite a few albums with Nico Elstrand from Entombed.
Oh, yeah.
He was on me like a fucking, you know.
Yeah.
Come on. You can do better than that. And, you know, we're not going to leave this room until you do this the way it should be. And we did a lot of harmony work and stuff like that as well, which takes forever.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. And I think we're a very warts and all band, but heavy metal, the type of heavy metal we do at least strives a bit toward Manowar, bit toward, you know, Dio era, Black Sabbath, kind of. So it must be rough and ready in the right way, you know. I'd be very disappointed if I was, you know, out of pitch or, you know, singing flat through a whole song and stuff like that. If I don't feel that I have it that day, forget about it. I'll come back tomorrow, you know.
This is very important to me, is that like, we'd be in the studio for, I remember where Greater Men Has Fallen, and we were living in the countryside, and being a city boy, I wasn't used to the noises of the countryside. And so I couldn't sleep. So we all had our separate rooms. So basically what was happening is that all the rest of them who have kids and work were getting up at 10 a.m. to want to work. And I'm like, I'll see you guys at 6 p.m. And it would drive them insane. And I was like, you can go to work today if you want. I'm not doing anything till I've woken up and blah, blah, blah. But between 6 and 9, I'll fucking fire through the work. And I'll just be like, da, 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 like what I have there. Yeah. But you know, you've got to be running the right headspace, the right mood. If I'm like a bit under the weather or tired, I can't pull out the singing. So it would infuriate everybody because I'd be like, no, you can't do this until you feel in the game. And unfortunately for everyone else, I'm a night. Time, you know, I'm a night bird, not a fucking morning person. So everybody had to like, all right, so we have to sit around all fucking day. It's like, well, you can go to work if you want, or then come back in the evening and we'll do it. But it would drive everyone insane because I turned the studio timing on its head. I'd want to work at like 11 p.m. or 10 p.m. Everybody's like, no, No, but I agree with you. I think you have to be in the right frame of mind, because it's coming. It's the noise that's coming from you. And this is what, when I argue with Kieran all the time, sometimes, you know, he'd be like, you just need to do this. And I go, well, you feel tired. You're trying to, it's a muscle. And you know yourself, if you're tired, yeah, you don't want to do weights, or, you know, if you're really, yeah, tired, you don't want to go running or whatever. It's kind of similar, but I'm not as much of a perfectionist. I think, or I like to leave in fallen notes and miss things. Like we did a song called Last Call on the last record, and Ola, really, the engineer, really kicked my ass for the harmonies and the timing, and we undid some of it because it was too
tight. Yeah, well, I totally hear you on that. I mean, but there's a huge gap from putting a lot of work into the vocals, and it varies, but from going there to like Def Leppard stuff,
oh yeah,
you know, that's not what we've that's not what we've been doing, you know. If heavy metal is too polished, then it doesn't have any, you know, there's no guts left in it, you know.
Yeah.
So, but like you said, for me, I mean, it's a very physical thing. Next to playing the drums, I would say that singing is, you know, you have to, your whole body needs to be,
yeah,
you know, ready. For me, if I'm doing guitar solos, I can pretty much, you know, have dengue fever and I could fucking do it, you know.
Yeah.
Not necessarily good, but if, yeah, I know what I'm supposed to play, I can play it, you know.
Yeah. I remember Sackis from Rotting Christ telling me that when they made Triarchy, The Lost Lovers, he was so, so sick with flu, but he could still play, yeah, the guitar. But when it came to the singing, he just found it. And, you know, yeah, so fucking hard to just stand up. Same thing happened to me with Redemption. I might have got a touch of swine flu. I don't know. We're in Wales, but I was leveled. I was on so many painkillers and this, that, and the other, and all this kind of stuff, just to stand up in the evening for a few hours of singing. I don't really remember some of it. I was so ill because I was just sleeping, yeah, all day and had asthma and all sorts of allergies, and, you know, it just exploded. But, it is such a physical thing. Have you ever lost your voice completely on stage or anything like that?
No, it never happened to me, luckily. Really? I mean, I've had rough nights, absolutely. And you know, if you have a cold or something, it's absolutely a struggle.
Mm.
But I've never lost it. I know you have.
It happened to me at Bloodstock in front of about 10,000 people, but it was so weird because I was kneeling at the front of the stage and I was like, and the voice, and I remember like a cloud of really dark smoke from the stage came across. And I remember, I remember singing and thinking, that smells fucking weird. Like a sort of very strong disinfectant-y kind of smell. And then instantly my voice just went like nothing. Like I couldn't even whisper. And what the fuck? I had to go to the bass player and he's like, what? And it just, like, it's rebounded. I think it's called temporary vocal cord paralysis.
But that must have been something you inhaled then from that smoke.
Yeah, that's what I felt like. You know, it literally just went from a full roar, like just instantly. Yeah. Like my vocal cord just went, nah. Like, you know the way if you cut yourself really badly or hurt yourself, your brain goes, we'll block that out. You know, I remember smashing my hand open playing hockey, and I could see all the tendons and the skin back of my hand. And I looked at it and my brain just went, okay, just blocked
goodbye.
It out.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe that's what it was, but you've never lost it like that.
No, but I, you know, I've had, but that sounds to me like not something, you know, that you did. It sounds like maybe something was on fire or whatever.
Or a chemical in the smoke or something, you know?
Yeah. But I mean, I've absolutely had gigs where I was mightily displeased with my own performance because of physical reasons that you couldn't perform the way you want. And also, monitors can be a real nightmare. And I have pretty specific, I know there is a certain frequency from the monitors where it, for me, feels effortless to sing.
Yeah, if they get it right, yeah, sure.
Yeah, and I've kind of tried with different sound engineers to dial that in, but sometimes the monitors can't, you know, they just start feeding back or whatever, and you can't have it like that. And this is something that I discovered pretty recently, I would say, like in the last 6 or 7 years or something. And before that, it was like every night, pretty much hit and miss, you know, and I never figured out what's the problem. I mean, I can hear my voice. That's not the problem.
Sure.
But it just feels so difficult to, and I'm talking about higher notes now. I've never had any problems with the low end.
I think what's lucky for you is that you're playing the guitar, so you're in charge of how loud the guitar also is in the monitor. In Primordial, I've got to battle two deaf goats on either side of me who want deafening monitors with no vocals in them. So
of course.
They don't want any, which of course doesn't help me out if I'm struggling in the middle. And then if you put them in the side fills, take them out of the side fills.
Yeah.
So it's like, but you're lucky because you're in control. Yeah. You're in control of the dark. Have you ever tried in ears? I couldn't do it.
For me, and I'm saying this in the humblest way possible, for me, it feels weird.
Yeah. It's like the sound of your own voice is too loud in your head or something.
Well, I've never tried it.
Yeah, I don't like it. I tried it once.
Idea,
yeah.
Yeah, okay. The idea in itself, again, comes back to what we were talking about earlier, the reason why you started, you know, playing in a band. And for me, it's you know, the very analog thing where there is that volume and you can hear the crowd and...
Yeah,
and I know you can put up mics in the audience so you get them, but it's not the same thing, you know?
No, I just tried it once and I just found it horrible. And also, even where in the, you know, you put the ones in which are the reducers, I find hard because then you can't hear the crowd or you can't hear.
So you don't have any earplugs at all?
I do. I do mostly, unless it's a very big stage and I don't really need them. But for a small club, yeah, I do. You know, the little ones which are the 10 dB reducers. But
yeah.
I've had to really try and force myself to use them because naturally it feels weird to, because your sound of your own voice is, you know, is really loud in your own head. And I don't, that puts me off or something, you know?
Okay. I've always used earplugs because which I'm thankful for today.
Yeah, in rehearsal always, but say in a big vacuum like stage, I don't use them. Because the sound is kind of diffuse, but in a small club of a few hundred, then I'll use them, you know. But still, a part of me wants to take one ear out to hear the, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's usually loud enough, I think, on stage anyway. But
yeah.
But in ears is a completely different thing, you know, where you, and it feels to me. I mean, earplugs is bad enough because it kind of isolates you a bit.
Yeah.
To take that yet another level further, you know, that for me, it's almost like you were in a different room than what's going on. Even if it's, you can hear yourself perfectly and blah, blah, blah. But that's not the point. The point is not to hear yourself perfectly, you know. But you have an advantage, even though you have the guitars to have a fight war with and everything else. And that's that you can move around
a lot
more.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can kind of, okay, here's a perfect position now when I'm going to do my power scream, you know, because I hear myself perfect over here.
Yeah.
My mic is in one spot.
Yeah, yeah.
Which means that if it fucks up there, I'm fucked, you know. I can't go anywhere else. And I'm not wearing a headset like Ted Nugent, you know.
Sometimes I'll step out over the monitors to the front of the stage so you hear the PA. So you're in front of it. If I'm struggling on the stage,
that's I'll go great.
Right
yeah,
up to the rim of the crowd. If I'm struggling with the monitors, and that's because you're like, oh, I can hear myself from the front of house almost, you know? That's great.
That's a real great option to have.
You could be like Raven, you'd be like Raven and have a little Britney Spears headset, you know?
Yeah, very sexy.
Yeah, indeed. So what are you going to do? What are you going to do now for, let's say the remainder of the year, do you think you'll try and sort of pick up the guitar again and try and write new songs for a new one? Or what's your feeling for the next 9 months or something?
Good question. I don't think I'm not going to force myself to do anything because I don't see the point for me personally. I will start thinking about music when I'm good and ready. That's the way I feel about it now.
And we have a whole list of gigs this year, which are slowly, I imagine, going to be tick, 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 cut, you know, cancelled. Do you have the same thing?
No, we were on tour when the whole thing happened. I remember. We didn't meet in Dublin, but we talked. Texted. And it was so crazy because 2 days after the Dublin gig, we were in England somewhere, Sheffield, I think. And we got the news that Dublin shut down every pub, everything.
Yeah.
And that was just 2 days after the gig. And then obviously it happened gradually in the UK as well. Mm. So we had to cut half of the tour, mainland Europe. So we did the last gig in London. We're lucky enough to get a flight home the day after. And then I was sick in bed for 2 weeks with the shit.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, so you have had this?
Yes.
Okay. And how was it? How did it feel? Bad or, well, obviously, but yeah.
No, it was lovely. Best time ever. No, it was pretty rough. I had fever for like 17 days or something.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And then I got better. And but like for 5 more weeks, I had like fever in the afternoon.
Okay.
Feeling okay, but in the afternoon, I just got the shivers and blah, blah, blah. But after 5-6 weeks, I was, you know, healthy again. Okay. But anyway, so we canceled that tour or postponed it to April this year. Mm. And then the promoters pretty early on in December or something said, you guys need to think about this again.
Yeah.
So now we postponed it to April next year.
Yeah, it's the same for us, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And the only question mark is a Swedish festival that's been postponed until August this year. Other than that, we don't have anything. And I don't think that one's gonna pan out.
Yeah, we have like 10 or 15 in the summer, but I think they'll all
really
I mean, you know, Hellfest and all this kind of stuff. So
yeah, yeah.
I guess they're all holding their breath to wait and see. But something tells me that they're not going to allow, you know, just people to randomly rub off each other in a field in mainland Europe.
No.
You know?
No, I agree. I don't want to be sound pessimistic about it. But, I mean, come on.
Mm.
30, 40,000 people in a field.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rubbing off each other and
Yeah. And you have like what 200 people per toilet and stuff like that. Yeah. That's not going to happen.
And no insurance company willing to insure it, most likely as well, which is something people don't really think about. Insurance companies aren't going to.
And also, you have the whole traveling thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like the flights are going to just start up like before.
No, also,
and also we don't know what the price will be either for flying. I mean, the prices were going up, you know, before this happened.
Yeah.
And it might be the situation that flying goes back to the way it was, you know, like in the 60s, 70s, where only very rich people could afford to fly.
Yeah, well, you know, if you're to believe certain, let's say, rumors in the political arena, that this form of lockdown will move into becoming an environmental lockdown, an eco lockdown. So therefore, flying will be clipped a little bit. I don't know, remains to be seen. I think that for us, though, if you have to quarantine on return, then you can't go anywhere. So effectively, you're grounded because you can't be in a band, go and play a festival, come back, quarantine, and then have a normal job. It just doesn't work like that.
No.
So, I kind of agree with you. I think it's just a case of sit and wait, see what happens. I don't think we really have a choice, you know?
No, I mean, if there was a choice, people would be, you know, exercising that choice, but there is no choice. And there's also the, I mean, what are you going to do? Arrange, unsolicited gigs or whatever. Yeah, you could do that. But then what are you doing? You're being very unsolidaric.
Yeah, I mean, I have some part of me wonders, okay, next year, the places you might be able to tour are South America, Russia, places which have a little different concerns about maybe health and safety to Western Europe.
Maybe,
I don't know. I mean, it remains to be seen. You just wonder, is the live music, entertainment, arts industry able to crack open the egg to allow it to live a little bit more without all of these constraints? I guess we can do nothing but wait and see, I guess.
True words.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.